Hi, everyone, and welcome to the special simulcast of the Neil Haley Show and the Love Is Podcast with our co-host and host of the Love Is Podcast, Kim Sorrell. Kim, how are you? And you know me and loving entertainment and talking about it because entertainment is my life. Former professional wrestler, all these things. Cannot wait to talk. And I know, Kim, as I've exposed you to the celebrity world in this past year, you're excited about talking to our guests.
I am indeed excited about talking to our guest, Gregory Orr, who just happens to be, first of all, an incredible guy in your own right. Like the things that you've done, what you do, the genius from starting from sweeping floors or whatever your beginnings, your humble beginnings to where you are today and directing and writing and the things that you do. And you also happen to be the grandson of Jack Warner, Warner Brothers, who is so well known. And then this documentary that you made is just incredible that shows your grandfather. That it's got to be just this whole different feeling of not just this person. I mean, it's big enough, right, Jack Warner? But that he's your grandfather. So how did this come to be? Can you talk to us about it?
Yes. Jack Warner, I knew as Grandpa Jack growing up. He was actually my step-grandfather. My grandmother married him when my mother was a little girl, was 9 years old. But he was my grandfather. I grew up with them. I went up to their 9-acre estate in Beverly Hills as a kid. You couldn't just show up there. You had to make a reservation because there was a studio guard at the gate, and it was a special occasion to go up there. But I knew him growing up. My father worked for him at Warner Brothers as an assistant and then head of television. My mother had been an actress at Warner Brothers, just starting off in her career. She's in a little movie called Casablanca, her first film role when she was 17, playing a young girl from Bulgaria who goes to Bogart asking for help. And so I knew these stories, but always from the studio side, from my family side. And I always had an interest in film and worked in film for many years, doing different jobs, including sweeping the floor of a special effects company that was making the Pillsbury Doughboy commercial. I like to say I was the Pillsbury Doughboy's dresser starting in my career. But when my grandfather died in 1978 and then my grandmother died in 1990, I knew a way of life, a unique slice of a classic golden age Hollywood was disappearing. That house, that beautiful 9-acre estate they were living in, was going to be sold. And all the contents were going to be sold at auction. The new owner, David Geffen, the producer and record maker and mogul himself, wanted to buy it. And my aunt was handling the sale, and he wanted to buy it with everything in it. That included the Oscars, which he didn't get those. But he got just about everything else. And he was a very shrewd businessman. You know, he was putting down a lot of money and he wanted to be able to sell off some of this stuff and make a little money back. And he did. He sold a bunch of things to Warner Brothers for, I think, maybe $3 million, you know, mementos and souvenirs and scripts that were bound. So I knew I had a matter of weeks to really go up there and just document it, just photograph. And I grabbed a friend of mine who had a camera, video camera, and we went up for a couple of days and just shot stuff, not knowing what to do with it. And out of that came the idea of, let's make a little movie about the house and their life. And then that grew into a larger movie, a biography of Jack Warner and Warner Brothers Studios and the four brothers who have founded Warner Brothers.
And being involved to do this, it's got to be an honor, right? To be part of this project, to look back in that
way. It's funny. When I think about, you know, what is your heritage, the lineage, you know, everyone's given something by their parents or grandparents, even if it's nothing. There are people who get nothing from their families and have to. That's what launches them in the world. I was given a tremendous amount, but it didn't necessarily help me in my own career directly. Being Jack Warner's grandson did not get me jobs. It was from a past generation. There were new people in place, obviously. But it did give me this rich history, which I had to sort through in a lot of ways, and my feelings about him and the effect he had on my family and the industry at large. And that's partly what the film was about. I mean, it's very much a look at him. It's not that much about me. It's a little bit about my memories of the house, but it's mostly about him. So it was a way to sort out my own feelings and discover who he was beyond the stories around the dinner table.
Yeah, that's interesting because there are a lot of stories around the dinner table, right? I mean, you know, he was known as being a pretty funny guy, but a pretty tough guy at the same time. And sort of, it seems like people either loved him or hated him or both at the same time. And he had a way of attracting the best of the best of the best when it came to actors and producers, directors, the people that he worked with. So when you hear all these stories about your grandpa, about the like, the dislike, the good, the bad, the ugly, the whatever, how does it play into what you know about your grandpa, how you saw your grandpa?
Well, definitely, as a, like I think a lot of kids, you hear the family stories, you have a certain image of your parents or grandparents or that crazy uncle who went off somewhere and married a Tahitian. But, you know, as you get older, you have to start, you start seeing it, or you should be able to see it as through adult eyes. And I had all this, you know, research available to me, all this material, if I wanted to go into the archives and obviously watch the movies or interview various people for the film who had worked with them, who knew him as friends. So I got a more nuanced picture of a guy who, you know, grew up pretty poor. I mean, they were struggling, they were working, but the parents didn't have much money in Youngstown, Ohio, had a butcher shop and a bicycle shop at some point. And, you know, the brothers, the four brothers, and Jack was the youngest. They want to be businessmen. So they opened up a bowling alley. They opened up anything they could, any kind of small business they could. And eventually they found their way to an early movie projector in 1904. And they got into the movie business at the beginning of a craze. People just went to see anything move. It was such a, you know, there was nothing else like it in your life. You had phonographs. You obviously had some live stage shows, but sometimes those were expensive. So movies were cheap. Nickelodeons are called that for a reason. They cost 5 cents. And you go in and see some little short film of something going on. And it whetted the appetite. And my brother saw this, like, this could be a great business. So they got in on the ground floor with a movie theater and then a film exchange showing all this. So these are all things I discovered that I'd heard the headlines about these and a few stories, but never really the business side. And I think the business side is a fascinating side of the movie business, of their development, Warner Brothers' rise from, you know, poverty to becoming one of the preeminent studios in the world. And they're just celebrating their 100th anniversary right now.
That's awesome to think about. We think about brands. How did they grow that brand? How did they visionize that brand? You think about the McDonald's brothers who helped the whole process of that brand of McDonald's, almost that same time period in that development. To, you know, Ray Kroc, how he grew it to McDonald's today. But what do you think, we speak about brands that, you know, surpass time, 100 years, and it's going to be on forever, Warner Brothers. What do you think made that brand so special?
Well, first, I'd say a commitment to adapt. That they got in, they had different names for themselves. They were incorporated as Warner Brothers Pictures in 1923. So that's when it became the company that we know today. But before then, they struggled to do you know, other kinds of businesses. And the thing they figured out, Harry Warner, the oldest, was a very shrewd businessman. And I'm told he could sell anything to anybody. So he was the one who was going and getting, excuse me, he was the one going out and getting money. He made sure he talked to whatever backers, investors, bankers, he made sure they had enough money to keep their operation, even though they'd often were on the verge of bankruptcy. And their first little movie company was closed down. They had to sell off to Thomas Edison's trust. Thomas Edison made a claim, since he invented the movie camera, not the projector, but the movie camera, that everybody had to pay him who wanted to make a movie or show a movie, pay him some royalty. And people hated this. And he finally squeezed them out. He wanted too much money and they couldn't afford. They had to get out from under the U.S. government finally broke that up and said, you can make a movie without having to pay Thomas Edison. But their brand, and they learned from the ground up what their audiences wanted, because they had these two little movie theaters. And so they saw the audience come in, what they liked. It also came from that very population, often an immigrant population. Their father had come from Poland, and the older brothers had been born in Poland. Jack was born in Canada when the father was up there. But so they were very close to the audience. And as they grew the business. It was very important to them to acquire, otherwise, you know, because there were hundreds or thousands of people doing the same thing they were doing, starting off with a little Nickelodeon, or maybe have a film exchange where you bicycle film prints around, you rent them to other theaters, and you're sort of the middleman between the producers and the theater. And that they kept going, and they finally acquired some other film exchanges, and they just kept growing because they had the resources to do it. That was an important, I realized that was an important component, that get backing, get financial backing for your plans.
Yeah, you know, I think I read that they started with like $150 to get.
And they had to scrape it together. They had to scrape it together to get that first projector.
Yeah, yeah.
You're absolutely right.
So here it's brothers, and not all brothers get along. And there are many brothers that go into business together and dissolve it before too long. But they hung in there for a while. What was the dynamic between the brothers?
I think of the Beatles or something as a band, you know, like they were like a band, and they all had unique skills. Harry being the oldest was a financial and business wizard. The next oldest was Albert, who was very quiet. He was not a showman in any way, but he was the treasurer and very honest, and his handshake meant something to people. And so they trusted him. Then there was Sam Warner, who was really the one who was the gadget guy and the man who got them into the movie business. He discovered this projector, this new form of entertainment, and got his brothers into it. And he was always tinkering around with what's the next step in movie making, movie development, and eventually got them the sound pictures. He's the one who helped push for sound in 1927. And then there was Jack, little kid Jack, who when they first started was a 12-year-old coming from Youngstown on the trolley to their first movie theater in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. And one of his jobs was to clear out the audience by getting up in between shows and singing. Because one of the problems was people would just stay and watch the show over again, and they wanted to clear it out for the next audience. And he'd get there and he'd stand up and sing badly, he claimed. And supposedly that would chase out people. So he was really the problematic younger brother who was always getting into some kind of trouble, mischief, and tagged along. So he wasn't really prepared to be the leader of the company. And later in 1956, in a deal that people thought was a betrayal, he was there when the brothers decided to sell their shares to a syndicate of bankers, and he bought his shares back, and the syndicate of bankers made him president of the company. So suddenly he was the lone Warner Brothers. But in between that time, it was very much competition between them, but also cooperation, tremendous cooperation to make the movies. And, you know, the older brother gave sort of the moral stance and the financial stance that we should make movies that educate and entertain and inspire. And Jack had to deal with the studio and all the actors and getting the right people and making it happen out in Burbank, California, at the studio lots that we know today.
So why The Last Mogul? Why did you the title The Last Mogul?
Well, he outlived his contemporaries who ran studios. Louis B. Mayer's, Walt Disney had passed away. Sam Goldwyn, all the ones who had started off in the early, the Zuckers of Paramount. So and they called him moguls. It's actually a word he hated. He said, I'm not some Indian prince, you know. So, but it seemed to fit. And someone has called Lou Wasserman of Universal a mogul. In some ways, he certainly was. He was more of a tycoon, because he didn't actually make movies. He was he ran Universal and had been an agent, was an important player. So I just thought The Last Mogul had a certain wistfulness to it also, that a time had passed. And that's the way I viewed it. And maybe the title would reflect the view of the film, an age gone.
Yeah, I read a quote from, I believe from you, that I love, that you talk about, you said, you wanted to bring the personalities to life, basically, is what it sounded like, and take them, and not just handprints on a sidewalk, but they were real people doing real things and the beginning of what we all enjoy. I mean, look at where we come with streaming services. And I mean, the movies that were made early on, even at Warner Brothers, are still being shown. And so the legacy just lives on and on and on, which I don't know anybody who's not passionate, who doesn't love movies and television and cartoons, and because Warner Brothers did it all. And so there's this passion behind it too. And there's just, what an incredible legacy you have. Like, how fun and what a wonderful tribute to your family, not just your grandpa, but really your whole family. And I admire you for that, because it took a lot of work to put this together. I don't know how many people are in it, but there are a lot. You got a lot of quotes from a lot of people. How did that work for you to get all that?
Well, it was interesting because the two families were separate. Sam died in 1927, working himself to death, getting the jazz singer, the first talking movie, up on the screen. And a day or two before its premiering in New York, he dies back in Los Angeles. And all the brothers actually rush to his bedside and are not there when that movie premieres in New York. So that's sort of that's a very much a tragic story. So there's really three brothers from that point on. And Jack and Harry do not get along. Jack wants to do things his own way. He's a very different personality from Harry, who's a very solid businessman and moral and married to the same woman for 50 years. Jack ends up divorcing his first wife, has an affair with the woman who becomes second wife, who is my grandmother. And the family doesn't like that and doesn't really treat her that well. So there's a lot of animosity, yet they work together. So for me, I didn't know the other side of the family, the Harry Warner's side of the family. I never met them until I reached out in making this film and talked to his granddaughter and met her mother, met Harry's daughter, and started getting some material from them too, and just branching out from the much smaller world I had growing up into a bigger. And Sam Warner's widow is in the film. She was there when all this happened. She'd been a young actress, and she can talk about what it was like and what Sam was like. And it was just great to have people who were there on the ground. Now, I made the film in 1993 originally. And in all this time, I said, this was my first documentary. It could be better. And I got to go back to it at some point. There's more material that could go in it. And in these 30 years, I really thought about it and prepared it. And then when Warner Brothers announced their 100th anniversary for this year, I said, now is the time to do it. Don't wait any longer. So I got all the new material, all the clips from Warner Brothers. They allowed me, they charged me a little bit, but they allowed me to take everything in high definition and 4K, the photos and up-res, what they say, up-res the interviews so they're pristine, and new score, new soundtrack, and really made a movie that hopefully could last for another 30 years at least, or another 100 years, as a great insight into a time that has gone. Because you can't get those people back. Most of them have died. And so I really wanted that to be preserved and to keep them alive. I feel a little guilty in some way. It's like my family album that I'm forcing onto the public. Like, here, look at my family pictures. But because they happen to be that family, there might be some interest in it. It's a little way to keep them alive for a moment.
So Kim has a love question to talk about. You can see your passion and love for the story. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah. Well, I dedicated a year, Gregory, to figuring out the true meaning of love, because there always seems to be this mystery, right? Like, if you put five people in a room, you get five different definitions, and it's sung about, it's in movies all the time, you know, whatever. But what is love really? So I dedicated this year to figure it out, and I did. I figured it out. And so I'm always curious, like, where love plays a role, where your love for family, for what you do, where does love fit into it all for you?
Well, I'll tell you how I came to love the movies. And I do think love has a lot to do with a selfless appreciation of the other or of something. It's not so much about you, because there's that kind of love. People say, I'm in love and I'm enamored of somebody, but it really has so much to do with what can somebody give you or something give you. I fell in love with movies, not by going to the movies in a movie theater, but by being able to visit Warner Brothers as a kid and watch them make movies. And I couldn't go very often, but I could sit on that soundstage and watch them make movies all day long. And that was a sense of watching them work together for common interest, which is to make that scene come off really well. All those people gathered around and beyond the camera, I don't know if people realize this, that when you're making a movie, all the lights and everything and the focus is on the actors in the scene. But on a soundstage, it's all somewhat dim and dark beyond that. So there's this pool of light that everyone is focused on and bringing equipment to and helping and costumes and so forth. And it was just a great, it's almost a holy tableau in a way of effort in this light. For what's going to be put on the camera. And I fell in love with that. And I wanted to do that in my life, is to gather people together and preserve or to make a fiction narrative or a documentary in that light. And that's what it was for me.
That's fabulous. Where can people watch the film? What's the best place?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. It's available on video on demand right now from Amazon and iTunes and YouTube and Vimeo and so forth. On demand also through cable platforms. And eventually, so you have to pay a few dollars to rent it. But so if you're eager, go to it. It helps me. But if you wait some months, it'll eventually be on Turner Classic Movies and other platforms, streaming platforms that you have a subscription to.
Well, I want to encourage people to buy it because it's a fun movie to watch. It's not just this documentary. Some people think documentary and their eyes glaze over, right? But this is a fun, fun movie to watch. You did an excellent job with it. Thank you for bringing it to the world, Gregory.
Thank you. I did want to entertain people while a little bit of education in there. So I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys. All right, guys. That was the special simulcast, the Neil Haley Show and the Love Is Podcast. Take care.